would be dressed in a protective shell like that guy. But it's not so easy. Players don't like to feel constricted or weighed down. They want to be able to play fast without hindrance. Many of them won't wear large shoulder pads, and even though NFL rules mandate knee and thigh pads, which help reduce injuries, players hate wearing them. Until the guys on the field learn to value safety more than performance, they are never going to lobby for safer equipment if they think it will limit them in any way. Given the chance, I bet some of them would go without a helmet if they thought it would make them faster. I'm exaggerating, but only a little. It's not talked about nearly enough, but every stakeholder in the game must make a concerted effort to educate players on the risks they face and how to mitigate them. That includes schools, conferences, leagues, teams, coaches, suits, and the players' union. While we're on the subject of helmets, there are smart people who think that if you removed face masks from them right now, players might be less inclined to lead with their heads. I don't buy it. Football skills are based on muscle memory and therefore are to a large degree instinctive. Unless players grow up tackling without a face mask, and good luck getting parents to agree to that, at some point they will unconsciously revert to their old ways. And if the game was on the line and it felt like a head-first tackle was the best way to stop the ball carrier, every player in the NFL would go helmet first, face mask or not. Instead, I have to believe there is some next-generation head protection just waiting to be created. For that matter, you'd think someone could invent body protection that allows for full range of motion. I mean, today, there are bulletproof vests that look like something Mr. Rogers wore every afternoon. Surely, with $14 billion in revenues, the NFL can afford to research and develop some appropriate armor for the players. I am not a headgear engineer, nor a neuroscientist, but I know that if my game is to survive, those roles will be as important as those of players and coaches. Of course, rules, equipment, and fundamentals can solve only so much of the problem. At the core of the issue is the fact that the players keep getting faster and stronger, and that means more impact-related injuries. I remember being in Cleveland at a reunion honoring the great Jim Brown, the storied running back, and noticing that Brown seemed like he was nearly twice the size of his left tackle, Dick Shathrath. Linemen then were not the giants they are today. That growth will just continue, which means collisions, even legal ones, will be more violent. In addition, careers now last longer on average, and that can only increase the cumulative damage the players will incur. There were no 40-year-olds playing at Tom Brady's level 40 years ago. Maybe he's a once-in-a-generation freak, but it's just as likely his fanatical conditioning program, from nutrition to workouts to next-gen recovery techniques, are what's keeping him revving at such a high level. I would expect that we'll see even more research into and focus on nutrition and conditioning in football. It's no exaggeration to say that Brady's body truly is his temple. In the old days, players treated their bodies more like carnival tents. Before the 1980s, most guys didn't waste the offseason staying fit. That's what training camp was for. In my time, though, I never spoke to a player who didn't say he was either heading to a workout or just getting back from one. Never. Potential wide receivers or defensive backs eligible for the draft are just as predictable. When I ask them what they'll run in the 40, the answer is always the same, 4.44. 20 years ago, that time was extremely rare. Trust me, I kept track of all the sub 4.50 timers at the combine and recorded no more than a handful of players that fast out of the 250 invited each year. Today, I no longer bother. I'd run out of ink. A sub 4.5 is the standard, not the exception. And with the increase in speed comes an increase in impact velocity. No rule change can fix or reverse that, not unless you change the fundamentals of physics or take tackling out of the game. And football without tackling isn't football. I mean, how would you like to watch the Pro Bowl every Sunday? Ending tackling ends the sport. Although I do not suggest messing with the basic premise of the game, I can only recommend a few healthy changes. Most important, we need to develop a better way to teach young players the fundamentals of tackling. As it is, every responsible coach in the country now teaches players to see what they hit. It's the first lesson of tackling. In fact, there's a giant sign on every locker room door in the NFL reminding players to keep their heads up. The problem is that until very recently, tacklers were taught to lead with their helmets, and that will take a while, perhaps even a generation, to unlearn. From the earliest age, kids need to learn to play the game the right way. I am a big fan of Pop Warner football, but I agree with all the recent studies that say that the bodies and brains of kids that age are just not ready to hit. The rush to introduce tackling leads to lifelong bad and dangerous habits. Another negative of Pop Warner is that too many young kids have yet to find their niche on the football field. For example, a fat kid, like I was, is automatically assigned to play offensive line when, in a few years, it's perfectly possible he will lean out and become a dynamite wide receiver. Problem is, if he has had a bad experience in the trenches, he will never stick around long enough to find his fit at a skill position. More than likely, he'll move on to another sport, and that's not good for football, a sport in which youth participation numbers have been in steady decline. To counter that, we need to develop passion for the game as well as the fundamentals to play it. A recent study advocated keeping kids away from tackle football until high school, and I agree. Youth football should be primarily a skill camp, teaching kids how to play a variety of positions properly. It will keep players healthy and interested until they are better able to deal with the rigors of tackle football. Bill Walsh, in his own way, was ahead of the curve on this. He pretty much invented the concept of keeping professional players fresh for Sundays by cutting down on padded practices during the week. He was no finesse coach. He definitely understood the importance of physicality, but he knew that going all out all the time was counterproductive. In Cleveland, though, Belichick noticed that whenever his players didn't wear pads, practice was slow and sloppy. As a result, he actually spent time teaching our guys how to get the most out of practicing without pads, how to take the right steps, use the proper footwork, make the necessary moves. It led to more high-intensity practices that were truer simulations of a game with much lower risk of injury or fatigue. Now, because of rules limiting padded practice during the season, it is more important than ever for teams to figure out how to recreate game intensity while practicing in shorts during the week. How do you improve technique without contact? I'm not certain, but I know that coaches will have to find a way to address this catch-22, instilling the proper fundamentals of tackling while limiting the amount of contact in practice. Today, teams use moving, motorized tackling dummies to help perfect technique. I'm curious to see what the next generation of computer-enhanced and robotic tackling equipment will look like. Another simple way to keep players healthy is to give them the proper time to heal by increasing game day rosters from 46 to the full 53. More eligible players means teams wouldn't have to pressure guys to return to the field, often through the use of pain-killing injections, before they are 100% ready. Now, I know this next suggestion is bold and perhaps drastic, but bear with me. I think making the game shorter would solve many of football's biggest problems. 60 minutes is a long time. How about playing 48, 12 minutes a quarter with maybe an 8-minute overtime? Calm down. I understand any changes to the official game time would screw up comparisons to all the historic stats. But the height of the pitcher's mound keeps changing, and the DH blew up the American League ERAs, and everybody in baseball somehow survived. It's just simple math, really. Fewer minutes means fewer impacts, which means fewer injuries. Also, all those injuries caused by late-game fatigue and poor technique could be avoided. And with the game's current emphasis on playing with tempo, cutting game time by 12 minutes wouldn't affect scoring or the drama all that much. In fact, it might enhance it. With each possession being that much more vital, coaches would have to utilize a different strategy. Instead of today's average of 12 possessions a game, teams would get maybe 9. Each series of offensive downs that didn't end in a score could cost the team the win. The whole game would become one desperate 2-minute drill after another. Did you see Super Bowl 52? It would be like that, only shorter. I rest my case. And yes, I know taking 12 minutes out of the game reduces the commercial space networks could sell. So make the halftimes longer. It will have the added benefit of offering teams extra time to get their adjustments down and medical issues dealt with. Make the time between quarters slightly longer too. Better that the commercials run then anyway, as it means fewer in-game interruptions to mess with the flow of the game. Would paying fans feel cheated? I don't think so. The games would be more exciting. Less would be much more. Along with reducing the game from 60 minutes to 48, my futuristic league would reduce timeouts from 3 to 1 in each half. The 2-minute warning would stay. Coaches will still need to manage the clock correctly, but that strategy would change a bit. In the fourth quarter, a trailing team would be reluctant to punt the ball away, as fewer timeouts would have them rightfully concerned that they might not get it back. Coaches will need to find a different way to gain control of the clock. Don't worry, it can be done. Think back to Super Bowl 51. The Patriots came back from 28-3 and still had 2 timeouts remaining when the game entered overtime. Sure, the Falcons' questionable play calling helped, but as crazy as it sounds, the Patriots were prepared for this extreme hurry-up contingency. Removing timeouts from the game would place greater importance on practicing real-time clock control. Doesn't it seem weird to you that basketball coaches have to call timeout to set up the final play of the game? Shouldn't the team have been trained in such a situation already? No team in the NFL spends more time preparing for those moments than the Patriots. From the first day of off-season training to the last weekend, Belichick has the team working on end-of-the-game situations, and never is a timeout part of the scenario. He wants his team to believe that timeouts are unnecessary. So yes, in my future, the Patriots already have an advantage. One thing won't ever change. Athletes will never stop getting bigger, stronger, and faster. Jim Hines, an Olympic sprinter in 1998, was the first human to break 10 seconds in the 100 meters. 50 years ago, his 9.95 was considered the limit of human performance. Today, he'd finished almost 11 feet behind Usain Bolt. That's a huge gap. He might not even be on the TV screen at the tape. Athletic evolution, coupled with today's more advanced training methods, has altered expectations and performance. There's no reason to believe that continuing advances in training and technology won't extend human limits even further. So the question becomes, how will tomorrow's superhero-style athletes change the way football is played? Well, player size won't change the way linemen do their job on either side of the ball. Big and strong is what their game is all about, so bigger and stronger won't rearrange that dynamic much. Maybe the left tackle isn't the marquee line position it once was, now that there are athletic defenders rushing the quarterback from so many different angles. But for the most part, these agile hulks will keep on fighting for territory in the trenches as they always have. But skill players, they're a totally different story. As they get more athletic and even better at what they do, offensive schemes will evolve to maximize their talents. When that happens, football will react the way it always does, by looking into the past to see its future. Most of you reading this will be too young to remember the single wings heyday. That formation featured an unbalanced line and 3 skilled players in the backfield. Sometimes the quarterback would line up behind a tackle or guard, and the tailback would line up behind the center and take the direct snap. Think of that crucial fourth down call in Super Bowl 52 when tight end Trey Burton passed the ball to quarterback Nick Foles, who had shifted out of his normal quarterback spot. It looked like a backyard play or something from the football future, but it was actually just a variation of the century-old single wing. Carl Snavely, the College Hall of Fame coach, who had a 180, 96, and 16 record in his years at Bucknell, North Carolina, Cornell, and Washington University in St. Louis, once said about the formation first invented by Glenn "Pop" Warner, "There's no way to improve on football beyond the unbalanced line single wing." Well, sorry, Carl, but Bill Walsh would like to disagree. That said, with so many talented athletes these days, offensive position designations may become something for the history books filed next to Hines's 100-meter time. Futuristic football will simply designate all non-linemen on offense as interchangeable skilled players, all of them capable of throwing, catching, or running with the ball. And guess what the best system is for such a scheme? Yep, the single wing. For more than 50 years, football has been slowly evolving back to its roots in rugby, and I, for one, can't wait to see what happens next. Basketball is evolving in similar fashion. Ben Simmons, the Philadelphia 76ers point guard prodigy, is still an outlier at 6 feet 10 inches, but he's a lot less of one than he would have been just a few years ago. These days on the hardwood, more and more players can play anywhere. We watch center-sized point guards pass to small forward-sized centers. Someday, all of football will look the same way. In some places, it's already started. Programs identify both the Eagles' Zach Ertz and Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce as tight ends on the basis of their size, but they're really much more like wide receivers lining up all over the field. Tight end has evolved from a glorified extra tackle to a unique skill position. It's a trend that will continue. Eventually, there will be a similar positional response on defense, smaller, faster linebackers or bigger, stronger cornerbacks to cover those massive receivers disguised as tight ends. If you push this theory a little more, who knows, we might eventually see Ben Simmons types at wideout being covered by 6-foot-10-inch corners. Hey, I can remember when 6-foot-5 inches was too tall to be fast. Give the drafts a little more time, and they'll be up to speed and running the West Coast offense, and our game will be one step closer to basketball on grass. How about this? Imagine if the Texans had a pair of Deshaun Watsons, two highly and equally skilled quarterbacks who were equally dangerous with the ball in their hands. Think of the stress you can put on the defense with both of those players on the field at the same time. Defensive coordinators would have no idea what to do. On one down, Watson 1 might be a passer throwing to Watson 2. On the next, Watson 2 might line up as a running back who fakes a sweep, pulls up, and throws an 80-yard bomb to Watson 1, who originally was lined up behind center. This, of course, would force the defense to attack differently. They'd have to defend players instead of plays. There would be a ton of man coverage and a need for the same kind of multidimensional players on defense because you'd never really know who was going to control the ball or where it might be going. Meanwhile, I bet owners would like a game populated with such human Swiss Army knives because the high cost of quarterbacks would sink when all but the most versatile skill position guys would have the same value. Instead of one quarterback making $10 million, you'd have 10 quasi-quarterbacks making $1 million each. Which plan seems more sustainable? Today's teams won't platoon quarterbacks because most coaches and schemes are heavily dependent on a reliable consistency under center and in the passing game. But as Al Davis once said to me, I'd rather be right than consistent, and the future will agree with Al. Consistency will take a back seat to scoring points. Classic drop pack passers are already getting harder and harder to find. Quarterback launch points are becoming more varied, not just behind the center, but behind the tackle or the guard or even outside the pocket near the sideline. And so eventually there will be much more movement in the backfield. First down will look like a Harlem Globetrotters weave drill, players sprinting in every direction, handing the ball off from one player to the next before Watson 1 launches a bomb to Watson 2. Come on, how much fun would that be to watch, even for only 48 minutes? In 1985, Feng Shuing Shu was a graduate student at Carnegie Mellon developing a computer that could play chess well enough to compete against the grandmaster. The project, first called Chip Test, eventually got Shu hired by IBM, and in 1996, the fruits of his team's labor, Deep Blue, faced off against Garry Kasparov, arguably the greatest human chess player ever. Kasparov won that match, but a year later, Deep Blue won the rematch. Artificial intelligence had proved itself more potent than the human brain, at least in chess. I can't help wondering when that will happen in football. Computers have revolutionized just about every aspect of our lives, from phones to music to maps, and there are times when it seems like football is the last holdout against technology. That's just not sustainable. In my vision of football's future, artificial intelligence will help coaches, not only on Sunday, but through the week. After all, I think chess and football have much in common, starting with the constant moves and counter moves that are the trademark of both. Deep Blue can simulate 200 million possible positions at a time. That kind of computer power sure would be useful on Sundays in the NFL. I can promise you, Deep Blue would not call a timeout with 2:05 left in the game. There's definitely potential here, even if the comparison is not exact. Chess is one move at a time. Football has 22 moving parts. Chess has no weather concerns, no injury reports, and no field position issues either. Still, think about it. Our kids hold tiny devices in their hands with almost as much computing power as Deep Blue, yet coaches still rely on hand-drawn charts to decide when to attempt a two-point conversion. Seems practically medieval, right? Like, say, using two sticks and a link of chain for the most important measurement in the game? Computers already have infiltrated football to some degree, but mostly for predictive stuff. Win probabilities, fourth down charts, and such. I don't think we are far away from a time when computers call plays, not coaches. Deep Blue analyzed billions of games in seconds to come up with the best possible moves for each particular situation presented by Kasparov. Surely it could match wits with the likes of Rex Ryan. Okay, the teams would need NFL approval to access their AI on game day at least. During the week, though, there would be no limitations on computer use, not for helping with the game plan, not for devising new ways to attack. Make no mistake, play callers would benefit from midweek data crunching and game simulations. Lots of play callers in the NFL watch a college game on Saturday night with their own call sheet in front of them to respond to game situations and help get their minds right for Sunday. It's a good enough mental workout, but doesn't it make more sense to use the unlimited power of a computer-generated game simulation to prepare? Advancements in computer science and technology may begin to pop up in other areas of football first, such as game and practice film. Some team will be the first to put cameras on every player in practice, so instead of watching one video of all 22 players on the field, coaches will be able to hone in on each individual player. The more detailed practice film gets, the more assistant coaches will be able to improve their teaching skills with things such as safer tackling technique. Imagine this. During a break, a player takes off his helmet and downloads the video of his last series to his screen on his wristband so that he can review it, study it, and learn from it. Because it is instantaneous, he can immediately put what he's discovered into action on the very next play instead of waiting until Monday to figure out what went wrong. Are you skeptical about these ideas? That's okay. I was skeptical that Batman's map could pinpoint the exact location of Catwoman's secret lair. Now we have maps on our phones that talk to us, show us satellite images from space of the restaurant we're trying to find, and warn us when there's a guy with a flat tire up ahead. I'm just saying. In any case, tune in tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel. Al Davis always liked to remind me that working in football is a lifelong commitment, not just a profession. Now I see how right he was. As long as you're involved in the game, you need to keep pushing. From the moment I turned on the engine in Bill Walsh's Porsche, I was given a firsthand look at the advantages of curiosity, continued study, and constant growth. Turns out those car ride classrooms were as much about life lessons as they were about football instruction. I hope I've been at least somewhat effective at passing those lessons on to you. I wrote this book because I wanted to show fans of the game I love what it really takes to build a championship team, to build a successful enterprise of any kind for that matter. Belichick always tells his players they need to take the classroom to the field. The rest of us do too. To my mind, the most important lessons boil down to a handful of ideas that are as powerful as they are simple. Culture comes first. You can have the best game plan or strategy or tactics, the best team or product or service, and the best players or engineers or salespeople, and you may achieve short-term success. But if you haven't created an underlying ecosystem of excellence, short-term success is all it will ever be. Press every edge all the time, because any edge may matter anytime. The great ones understand that a focus on details is crucial, not because they know what will matter when, but because they don't. System over stars. Obviously, I have seen some superstars up close in my day. Jerry Rice, Joe Montana, Tom Brady. But superstar is the second way I describe each. The first is superb system guy. Talent matters, but willingness to buy into the program matters more. Leadership is a long-term proposition. Devotion to the process has to matter more than chasing the score. True leaders always value sustainable success over quick fixes. Much as empire builders such as Warren Buffett and Jeff Bezos have ignored the quarter-to-quarter earnings game, dynastic coaches ignore all distractions. Fan pressure, media scrutiny, player grumbling, once they are convinced that a decision is right for their team. You're never done getting better. Greatness over time is in direct correlation to growth over time, and growth over time requires finding new ways to do the same old things. Real leaders, real achievers, real champions are never done learning. Real front office guys, too. I may no longer be employed by the league, but the game is still an important part of me, and it always will be. These days, I'm teaching my two grandsons, Dominic and Leo, all about this great game. And to do that, I have to keep learning, especially from my mistakes. That's one reason I have a category of people I call change my mind guys. At first glance, this group of players and coaches didn't impress me all that much. But over time, they force me to reevaluate them. It can be a humbling exercise. And at this stage of my career, I can tell you, these change my mind guys often end up leaving the biggest impressions. Malcolm Butler is one of my all-time favorite change my mind guys. When I was with the Patriots, we originally signed Butler on little more than a look-see deal. And the next time I looked, I saw a guy who had won us a Super Bowl. After more than 30 years in the business, Butler finally changed my mind about scouting talent from smaller schools. My latest change my mind guy might be the greatest one of them all, Eagles head coach Doug Peterson. I freely admit that after he got the job in Philadelphia, I considered him one of the worst hires ever. I mean, he was an offensive coordinator who had never even been a full-time play caller in the league. There was nothing to suggest he was worthy of or ready for the head coaching job. Honestly, nothing he did in his first season in Philadelphia, where he basically just copied the Chiefs' attack, caused me to rethink my assessment. But in 2017, the originality of his offense and the leadership, teaching skills, and game planning he showed while winning the Super Bowl with a backup quarterback were nothing short of masterly. I want to say one more time to him in the football world, man, I was wrong. But that's the thing. After it's all said and done, football is really a game of surprises. I'll be sure to let Dominic and Leo know that. It will be lesson number one in our first car ride classroom. This is Michael Lombardi. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Gridiron Genius, a masterclass in winning championships and building dynasties in the NFL. This program was directed by Alan Tobin, executive producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2018 by RFK LLC. Forward copyright 2018 by Bill Belichick. Production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.